All right, well, let's see. Today we are going to talk about the Exodus. It's sort of a key event in biblical history. I can't recall, when we talked about a chronological chart, did we go into all the scriptures that deal with the date of the Exodus? Okay, good. Well, we don't have to go into that. Let me give you a handout here. And those scriptures are repeated here. So, just in the way of review, 1 Kings 6:1, of course, gives us the 480 years from the time of the building of the temple under Solomon back to the time of the Exodus. And that becomes our key scripture. Provides us with the most accurate dating for that Exodus event. But that's not the only scripture. We have as well Judges 11:26, 1 Chronicles 6:33-37, and the chronological data given in the book of Judges. And so we've covered this, and it pushes us back to sometime in the mid 15th century B.C. for the event of the Exodus. We can't be precise about it. It has to be a kind of a plus or minus date, but nevertheless, it has to be in the mid 15th century, because we run into what I think are insurmountable problems if we attempt to move that date significantly from the mid 15th century. So I'd like to begin by looking at Exodus chapter 1. Now, last time we talked about the Joseph story, and that is the event that is recorded for us during the Egyptian sojourn. But we do have just a little bit of information here in the first chapter of Exodus. And I'd like to consider these verses here. And this, of course, deals primarily with the end of the period of the Egyptian sojourn. Altogether, it lasted 430 years. You can see on the handout, I've kind of worked out some key dates. If we set the Exodus at 1450 and then add the 430, that takes us back to 1880 as to when Jacob and his family entered Egypt and the beginning of the sojourn. Again, these seem to be rounded off numbers in the Old Testament, so we might be off a year or two one way or another, but we can't be too far off. and then after the period of about 30 years, it seems that the Israelites were subject to affliction and slavery, because we're told that they were slaves for 400 years. So those gives us some rough dates at the beginning of the period, and then we can work out a chronology for Joseph, as we talked about last time. But now, the material here in Exodus chapter 1 is a little bit puzzling as to exactly when these events are taking place, because we're not given any real chronological hooks here to know when these things are happening. Of course, when we get to the birth of Moses, then we can tie that in, because we know that Moses was 80 years old when the Israelites left Egypt. So we can work back from our 1450 date and come up with a birth date for Moses. Similarly, Aaron was 83 years old at the time of the Exodus when they appeared before Pharaoh. So we can work out Aaron's date of birth. But let's look at Exodus chapter 1 here. And the first six verses deal with just an overview, names of the family that came into Egypt. And then it says that in verse 6, Joseph, all his brothers, and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. So it seems we have a passage of time here from the end of the time of Joseph until the present events that are going to be described for us. The Israelites multiplied, they became numerous, so we have decades, well, probably several centuries going by. And then in verse 8, we read, "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt." Who is this new king? This has been a matter of some puzzlement and speculation. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. Now, I'd like to stop at that point because I think we have a break between verses 11 and 12. The mention here of these two sites, Pithom and Ramses, I believe, enables us to put these verses into their proper chronological position, verses 8 to 11. Pithom, now most scholars would agree, is the site of Tel Ratava in the Wadi Tumilat in Egypt. I don't have my overhead. Well, here we can use this one. This actually is for the next hour, but let's have a quick look at it to see where Tel Ratava is. This is the Wadi Tumilat right here, an east-west valley going from the Nile River Valley over to Lake Timsa here. And we have a number of sites along that valley. It was an east-west passageway from the central Sinai into the heartland of Egypt. Pithom is right here, about 25 kilometers perhaps from Lake Timsa here. And at Lake Timsa, we have the modern town of Ismailia. Right here is the site of Tel Ratava, and it's been identified as ancient Pithom. You might read that it's located at another site close by called Tel El Maskuta, but now most scholars believe Maskuta is Sakkah, which we'll talk about when we talk about the root of the Exodus, and that would leave Tel Ratava as being Pithom. Now, Pithom has not been extensively excavated. There's been a few soundings. We just don't have a lot of information from that site. But we do know that it was occupied during the Hyksos period. We have Hyksos-type pottery or Canaanite-type pottery there from the Middle Bronze Age period. We also know that it was occupied in the New Kingdom period, the 18th dynasty. All right. The name itself, Pithom, I am not entirely positive about it, but I think it's a later name. I don't know how far back it goes. I know it goes back to the time of Merneptah, I believe, but that would be quite some time after the sojourn. The other site, Ramses, we know a lot more about. Ramses is at Tel El Daba. And here's Ramses, some distance northeast of Pithom. And the modern name is Tel El Daba. You might also see it related to Kantir. That's a modern village close by. This site has been extensively excavated by the University of Vienna and the Austrian Archaeological Institute beginning in 1966 and continuing to the present time. The work is under the direction of Manfred, M-A-N-F-R-E-D, Bietek, but B-I-E-T-A-K. BTEC has found a very rich site here at Tel El Daba, and he, in fact, has identified it as ancient Kantir. No, excuse me. Ancient Avaris. Yeah, Avaris. A-V-A-R-I-S. Avaris, the Hyksos capital. We know the name of that capital from the Egyptian records of the driving out of those Hyksos leaders, and their capital was called Avaris, and it was known to be somewhere in the Eastern Delta, and there was some controversy about the several possible locations, but with the excavations now of BTEC here at Tel El Daba, there's no question but what this was the capital of the Hyksos. It's a fascinating site. It's today all agricultural fields. It's not actually a tell, although there's one part that's raised a little bit. I don't know why it's called a tell, but it should be a curvet. That's a kind of a flat ruin. But at any rate, it's all agricultural fields today. And so what they do each season, they open up maybe 4 squares or so, excavate the area, plan all the buildings, and then after they're done, fill it in and move over next season and dig next to that, plan those buildings, and continually do that. And they're turning the area back over to the farmers for cultivation, but they're recovering the plan of the ancient city, plus, of course, a lot of artifacts. The ruins of the Hyksos capital are just below the surface. They hardly have to, as soon as they get down below the depth of the plow, they're into the ancient material. So they are slowly recovering the whole plan of the Hyksos capital, the palaces, the temples, the cemeteries, the homes, and so on. And you go into the dig house, they have a permanent building there that they've erected because this is a long-term, ongoing project backed by the Austrian government, a luxury that we don't have in the West. And so they're going to be there for the long haul. And you go into their dig house and go into the room where they do their drawings and look at the walls, and here they've got these drawings pasted together from all their seasons, and you have this huge city slowly taking shape as they add the plan, and it's just incredible. The area that they've excavated over these years and the plan that they have reproduced. So it's a fascinating dig. Of course, rich in Hyksos material, that is Canaanite material. So they have here Middle Bronze, Palestinian pottery and other artifacts, burials and so on, definitely not Egyptian. And so they've been able to pretty well trace the history of this site and the development of this culture or these people in Egypt. Another controversy was how the Hyksos came to power. And basically there were 2 schools of thought. There was kind of the infiltration idea that slowly over a long period of time they infiltrated Egypt and became more numerous and then eventually overthrew the native rulers. And then there was the invasion idea that they came in all at one time as a screaming horde and just took over Egypt. Well, BTEC's work has shown that it's the former theory, that these people began coming in well before the time when they took over as rulers. It goes back to Middle Bronze 2A, about 1800 or so B.C. They began coming into the area. We have evidence in the Delta area and at Tel El Daba. So we have learned a lot from his dig about the Hyksos and their capital and how they came to power and so on. And then, in fact, we can correlate the end of the Hyksos or Canaanite occupation with the expulsion of the Hyksos in 1550 1550, did we say? 1560. 1560 on our chart there. That's precisely when the Canaanite occupation ceases at Tel El Daba. In addition to that, the fact that we have Palestinian material here is highly significant because, of course, he has a lot of Egyptian artifacts in with the Canaanite material, which allows him to date the Canaanite material. In Palestine, we can only work out rough dates, approximate dates, through synchronisms with Egypt. But here he's got some more precise data and information. And as a result of his findings there, he is advocating somewhat of a radical revision of the Palestinian dates. He's advocating lowering the traditional dates for the Palestinian Middle Bronze period. And that's caused a bit of a controversy amongst the traditionalists. And so there's been some articles back and forth, him presenting his new chronology, others fighting it and trying to uphold the older chronology that's been around since Albright, basically. So we're undergoing a period of, reevaluation, I guess, for the Middle Bronze period and the transition from Middle Bronze to Late Bronze. Also, BTEC answered another question or controversy in Egyptian archaeology, and that is the site of the city of Ramses. We know Ramses from the Old Testament, of course, but we also know Ramses from Egyptian history. There was two schools of thought on the location of Ramses. One, which I think most people followed until BTEC began his work, was that Ramses was located at the site of Tanis, T-A-N-I-S, which is sort of west of Tel El Daba. Because at Tanis there were a lot of inscribed building blocks with the name of Ramses II on them. So everybody thought, well, this must be his city, the city that Ramses II built here in the Delta. But yet there was some few people that held that no, Ramses was really located over here at Kantir, the area of Tel El Daba, because there had been a few items found in that region as well. No structures, however, simply some stray artifacts here and there, base of a statue and some glazed tiles that appeared to be from a palace and different things that led some scholars to believe that Ramses was located here at Kantir. Well, what the BTEC discovered was that there were foundations from the city of Ramses the Great, and that later rulers, I think Shishak, maybe some before him, took the blocks from the buildings at Kantir and transported them over to Tanis when they changed the location of their capital. So those blocks at Tanis had been moved there in later history, and they were not originally there. And he demonstrated that all the building blocks were upper blocks. There were no foundational blocks that you could date to the time of Ramses II. So BTEC has found really a wealth of evidence to show that Kantir was the site of Ramses. So that cleared up yet another controversial matter. Well, so we know now where Ramses was located. A few years ago, there was debate and question and so on. There's no question. I think everybody agrees with BTEC's findings. So we know where Ramses was located here at the site of Tel El Daba. And it was the next city to be built on the site after the expulsion of the Hyksos. So the Hyksos were driven out around 1560. There was still some evidence of some amount of occupation for a little bit after that, but it didn't last too long. It eventually died out within a few decades. So BTEC's reconstruction is that it was the rulers who were driven out, not all of these Canaanite people that were living there, but it was the rulers, the upper echelon, the elite that were driven out, and the common people probably continued to live there for a time, but it was no longer a great capital city. At any rate, there was no occupation at the site in the 18th dynasty. At least none has been found to date. But then Ramses II built his great city in the 19th dynasty, around 1300 BC or a little after that. Look on your chart of your kings there. You can see the dates for Ramses II. I think he began his rule 1290 or so. So that's a bit of a problem with regard to the matter of the Exodus. Because most people would say that the Israelites were building these cities of Pithom and Ramses just before they left the country. And if they left in 1450 B.C., there was nothing there in 1450 B.C. In fact, this one verse, Exodus 1:11, is the strongest evidence for the later date of the Exodus, putting it into the reign of Ramses II, because, of course, the mention of building the city of Ramses, and that did not happen until the 13th century. And so that is a basis then for a 1270 Exodus date. But it's at this point in time, it's the only basis. At one time, there seemed to be other factors which entered in that supported that date, and I'll go over these next week. But at this point in time, all those other factors have dissolved and disappeared and dissipated, and the only thing that the late date has going for it at this point in time is Exodus 1:11. Now, how do we resolve this difficulty here if we hold to the biblical date of 1450? I believe the answer is that these three verses here, 8 to 11, are talking about the Hyksos period. And that the new king, who did not know about Joseph, was the first Hyksos king, whose name was Kayan, K-H-Y-A-N, who came on the throne, or came into power about 1668. Well, this is some 200 years before the time of the Exodus. This king did not know about Joseph because he was non-Egyptian, and he had no knowledge of the details of Egyptian history. I'm sure a native king would have been familiar with those events that took place several hundred years before this time. So that, I think, would fit in, this new king who did not know about Joseph, a foreigner. And then he said to his people, and this is a rather strange phrase, if this new king was an Egyptian, why would it be worded in that fashion? He said to his people. It sounds like his people are foreigners as well. And I believe they are the Hyksos, or the Canaanite people that are being talked about here. The Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. Of course, their enemies would have been the native Egyptians. The Hyksos had overpowered the native Egyptians. And here is a group of people, the Israelites, living in the same area as the Hyksos in the eastern delta, living amongst them in that whole area, becoming a very large population. And so they represented a threat to the Hyksos, because if the Israelites should side with the Egyptians and rise up against these Canaanite peoples, then they could possibly drive them out. So I think that's the concern here. And so they oppressed them and made them their slaves. And these cities that they built were the Hyksos cities at Tel Ratava and Tel Eldaba, or the site of Avaris at Tel Eldaba. Why are they called Pithom and Ramses? Now, Pithom might be an ancient name, I really don't know, but we know for sure Ramses was not an ancient name. It did not come into being until the 13th century. Well, I think it's simply a case of updating these names after the ancient names or the original names had gone out of use. So that what was originally Avaris was later revised to Ramses, because everybody knew the name of Ramses after the city was built there with that name, and the name of Avaris just fell into obscurity. Nobody knew anything about Avaris after the time of Ramses II. Now we have quite a number of similar examples of this thing, this type of thing in the Old Testament. I'll just list these very quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this point, but I think I just want to validate this reconstruction of things. First, the city of Shechem. It's mentioned in Genesis 12:6, but the city was not named Shechem until much 12:6, of course, is in the time of Abraham. Shechem was not named until the time of Jacob. It was named after Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hittite, I guess he was, over in Genesis 33, verses 18 and 19. We have the city site of Bethel, Genesis 12:8. Abraham built his altar between Bethel and Ai. Well, Bethel, again, was named by Jacob much later on. He gave the site that name, House of God. But the name Bethel is used back earlier in the time of Abraham. And we have a few passages where it gives us the ancient name of Luz, L-U-Z, and it will say, you know, Bethel, which was Luz, or Luz, which was Bethel, or something. But in Genesis 28, there's no indication that there was another name for that place in Abraham's day. It just says Abraham camped between Bethel and Ai. Hebron, again, the name appears in Genesis 13, 18, 23, 19, but it seems that that name was not given to the site until the time of the conquest. And we have some references to it over in Joshua 14, verses 13 to 15, where it speaks of Hebron, which was Kiriath Arba. But again, the name, the later name is used earlier on with no explanation. The site of Dan, of course, it was ancient Laish. In Genesis chapter 14, Abraham chased the Mesopotamian kings as far as Dan to recover Lot. Dan was not named until the migration of the Danites around 1275 B.C. That's described in Judges chapter 18, and verse 19 is the giving of the new name to the site. So hundreds and hundreds of years after the time of Abraham, the name was given to that city. The earlier name was Laish, but in the Abrahamic narrative, the later name of Dan is used because everybody's familiar with the name of Dan. That's what it was known as in the kingdom period. Samaria, mentioned in 1 Kings 13:32, before the time of Omri, 50 years before or something, and then the city was not founded until the time of Omri, 1 Kings 16:24. And then the name Ramses itself that we're dealing with here, it appears back in the Joseph story in Genesis 47:11. Where the Israelites were settled in the area of Ramses. And it's the same area around the city built by Ramses II. So the name is given to that area because that's what people were familiar with in later times. Now, this is an interesting point because scholars will take Exodus 1:11, the name of Ramses here, and they'll say this is proof for the 13th century exodus and conquest, the use of this name here. But nobody has ever suggested that the Joseph story should be brought down to the 13th century. It's okay there. Name here in Exodus 1:11 cannot be updated. A person who kind of follows this reasoning is Kitchen, K.A. Kitchen. He has no problem saying that the name Ramses back in Genesis 47 is a later updating of the name, but he will not come to that conclusion for Exodus 1:11. So, yes. So here's a bunch of examples that shows that this sort of thing was not uncommon, and I believe that's the answer here, because we have Hyksos remains at both of these places, Tel el-Retaba, Tel el-Daba, and I believe that's the time the Israelites were there under Hyksos building those two cities, and of course Ramses was their capital, and they would have made use of slaves to build their capital. Question?
This changes
I think it's later updated, after the time of Moses. Yeah, sure. Because a lot of these names that I mentioned here are well after the time of Moses.
No, I mean, for example, you said that there might be a big jump in time between Exodus 1:11 and 1:12, right?
Yes.
So, if there's a big jump, so during Moses' time,
Well, there was no town there in the day of Moses. What we have in these three verses is just some record that was kept and passed along from the time of the Hyksos period.
So you're saying that when Moses wrote, it was
Averis,
and they thought
it was. Well, yeah, because Ramses had not been built yet at the time of Moses. It wasn't built until the 13th century. Okay. Now, the one problem people might raise with this reconstruction is that at the end of verse 11, we have the name Pharaoh used. These cities were built as store cities for Pharaoh. Well, would the Hyksos king be called Pharaoh? Yes, indeed, they were called Pharaoh. These Canaanite kings took on all the titles, all the attributes of an Egyptian pharaoh. They copied everything that the pharaohs did. They had statues made, and they had cartouches. They did everything that the pharaohs did, and they took on the title of pharaoh. Much of the information about the Hyksos is gone, because when the native Egyptians drove them out, they obliterated all their monuments and tried to just wipe them out of their history and out of their memory. But a few things have survived. We have a few statues and a few things, but there's not much from that period. We don't know an awful lot about what was going on in those years. All we have are the Egyptian records, which are referring back to this terrible time in their history. Then when we come to verse 12, we have another time lapse. It tells us here, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. Now I think we've come down to the time after the Hyksos period, when the native Egyptians were once again in control, were after 1560. So the Egyptians now dreaded the Israelites. Well, now, why would the Egyptians dread the Israelites? They had just gone through the most bitter experience of their history, with these foreign kings coming in, these foreign rulers coming in and taking over their land for a period of 108 years. They took a number of steps to ensure that this never happened again. They sealed off their eastern border. They campaigned into Canaan and made it a province so that they wouldn't have to worry about people coming in from the north and taking over again. And so I think this is a sort of a backlash to the Hyksos experience here, and that the Egyptians were afraid of the same thing repeating itself. That's how the Hyksos came into power. They came into the land slowly and more and more and more, and pretty soon there's just a huge number of them in the land, and somehow they came into power. We don't know how. We know from the work of BTAC, and in fact, I did work very near to the site of Tel Ratava, just a couple kilometers away, at Tel Mascouta. We had a survey in our area. We found at our site Hyksos material, and in the survey of the area around our site, we found quite a number of Hyksos sites with the Canaanite, typical Canaanite pottery. So they took over and occupied quite a large area, and in fact the Israelites did as well, took over the whole eastern delta. So I think the Egyptians here are fearing that possibly the Israelites would multiply and get to the point where possibly they could overthrow the native Egyptian rulers. And so they then oppressed them as well. So they worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor, brick, mortar, and all kinds of work in the fields, and all their hard labor, and in all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. That's just an overview, I think, from the time of the Hyksos, from the expulsion of the Hyksos down to the time of the birth of Moses. Beginning in 15, we have the death decree. The king of Moses said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Puah, and incidentally, these are good Egyptian names, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God, did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do, and they let the boys live. The king summons them and questions them about this. Verse 20, "And so God was kind to the midwives. The people increased, became even more numerous, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, 'Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live.'" Well, we're getting close to the birth of Moses now, and I think the Pharaoh in this case, in verse 15, the king of Egypt who made this death decree, would be Amenhotep I. We have a little bit of evidence to date when this particular decree was enacted, and that's based on the age of Aaron and the age of Moses. As I just mentioned, when Moses and Aaron appeared before Pharaoh, we're told that Moses was 80 and Aaron was 83. Exodus 7:7. So evidently Aaron was born with no problem. At least we have no indication in Scripture that he had to be hidden or anything like that. But when we come to the birth of Moses just 3 years later, the death decree was in place and he had to be placed in the ark and so on. So it's quite conceivable that this death decree took place between the birth of Aaron and the birth of Moses, between 1533 and 1530. That being the case, then, it would be Amenhotep I. If you have your sheet handy, you can look up his dates readily and see when he ruled. Yeah, that's the one I'm using for the dates. That seems to give us the best correlation with the Bible. Now, when we look at the Exodus problem, well, in fact, the whole Exodus conquest problem, it's a large problem.
we have two groups of data that we have to work with. On the Exodus side, we have to work with the Egyptian data. So we have to correlate our biblical references with the Egyptian material to see when it all fits together. Then, with regard to the conquest, then we have the Palestinian data that we have to work with, the archaeological data concerning destructions and that sort of thing. These two, of course, are linked by the 40 years in the wilderness, so the Exodus and the conquest are separated by the 40 years. So you have to integrate the data on the Egyptian side and the data on the Palestinian side to get it all fit together. And of course, we're going to look at the biblical data over all of this. So, overarching, it's the basis for our reconstruction, but we have to fit our archaeological and our historical evidence into the biblical references to see how it all falls out. So, and now, when we come to Exodus chapter 2, we have references to events that took place at the time of the Exodus that we have to correlate with Egyptian history. First of all, we read in Exodus 2 of this problem that Moses had in murdering the Egyptian. And so he had to flee because he feared for his life. We read over in verse 23, while Moses was in the wilderness, let's see, we can again figure out when he fled, because we know he was 40 years old at that time, so he fled in 1490. Our 1450 date is approximately correct. And, of course, he after 40 years, he comes back to Egypt at God's direction, so he came out of the wilderness in 1450. But during this time, while he's in the wilderness, we read, verse 23, during that long period, the king of Egypt died. So, we would have to have the death of a pharaoh occurring during this 40-year period while Moses is in the wilderness. And if you look at your chart, you'll see that the most likely candidate, or if we go with the 1450 date, the only candidate is Hatshepsut. And I think we talked about Hatshepsut. She took over as ruler because Thutmose III, the legitimate ruler, was a minor, was very young when his father died. And so his stepmother, and I think she was his aunt, if I recall correctly, she took over as the queen and, in fact, ruled the country as a pharaoh. Now, in this passage here, the king of Egypt is in the masculine. Could that be a problem? Well, no, because there again, Hatshepsut took on herself all the titles of a male king. And in her own records, she uses the masculine title of pharaoh. So that's no problem, because that's the title she took on. And so that would fit very nicely. And then after this, after her death, then Thutmose III becomes the sole ruler. And the first thing he does is to begin campaigns into Palestine and further north into Syria. He had 20 campaigns or something like that. He campaigned annually up in that region. And I think we talked about his first campaign into Palestine against a coalition of kings that were in Megiddo, and he defeated that coalition. And this really marked the beginning of the area as being a province of Egypt. So that took place right around the time Hatshepsut died, and in fact is a convenient marker for the end of the Middle Bronze period and the beginning of Late Bronze. Well, we see that after this event, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of the slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. So it appears that once again, the Israelites came under a very severe oppression after this event of the death of a pharaoh while Moses was in the wilderness. Again, this would fit in quite nicely with Egyptian history because Thutmose now begins his northern campaigns. To conduct these campaigns, of course, Egypt had a vast army, so they would need supplies, equipment, and he would need bases in the Eastern Delta area from which to launch these campaigns. So it's possible then that the Israelites were employed in provisioning Thutmose's army at this time. Now, if you would like to have a later Exodus in 1270, there's no pharaoh that died at that time that would fit in with this event as we have it here. We're also told when Moses returned over in Exodus 4, verse 19, when God tells him to go back, he says, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead." Well, now here it says men. It doesn't say mention a particular pharaoh. Of course, the pharaoh had already died while he was in the wilderness, but here it seems to be a reference to the officials that had been in power back 40 years earlier when he fled. Now they're all dead, and so he can return safely. The other key thing where we can make a correlation between biblical events surrounding the Exodus in Egyptian history is the matter of the crossing of the Yam Suf, Exodus chapter 14. And here we read in verse 28 that after the Israelites had crossed the sea, that the Egyptians went in and were told that the water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. I'm not so sure it tells us if Pharaoh was with them. It says the Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses. But at any rate, over in Psalm 136, verse 15, it doesn't leave any doubt in our mind, because there it tells us that Pharaoh perished in the sea at that time. 136 and verse 15, but swept, this is talking about the whole event, but swept Pharaoh and his army into the Yam Suf. So that means then that if Pharaoh died the year of the Exodus, or at the time of the Exodus, well, we see according to the chronology of Wente and Van Sicklin that Thutmose III died in the year 1450 B.C. That's why I like his chronology as opposed to the lower one, because you don't have any such alignment. And again, if you would want to put the Exodus in the 13th century, you have no pharaoh dying at the time of the Exodus. Ramses II, who would have to be the pharaoh of the Exodus, lived well beyond the 1270 date that people put forward as the date of the Exodus. He lived to, 1230 or 12, yeah. So you would not have a good fit with Egyptian history if you pursued the 13th century date for the Exodus and conquest. In addition to dying in the right year, Thutmose III died in the right time of the year. We know the exact date of his death, in fact, from a record. I don't have it written down here, but at any rate, there is a record that gives his date of death as March 17th, 1450. Of course, it would be in the Egyptian system, but when you work it out in the terms of the Julian calendar, it's March 17th, 1450. Well, the Exodus had to have occurred in the spring, because that's when Passover is observed, is in the spring of the year. And so again, we have a very nice correlation between the time of the death of Thutmose III and the Passover and Exodus.
If the date of 1450 is so accurate, why did K.A. Kitchen not use that and use the 1425
then? He believes in the late date for the Exodus, 1270, based on Exodus 1:11. And I don't know how he resolves the discrepancies between the biblical references and Egyptian history. He doesn't discuss it. He just says he believes the Exodus took place in 1270 because of the reference to Ramses in Exodus 1:11. Nobody follows it. A few diehard evangelicals. Yeah. Even
the death of Thutmose III is fixed.
Well, yeah, the year, though, is floating, you know, according to these different systems that are on the sheet.
So it doesn't have a year until the war,
Well, we have the problem here is in interpreting an astrological observation, the rising of the star Sothis. But where was the observation made? That's the point. If it was made in one city, you get one date, another city, you get another date. And so there's a range, you know, and people come up with a high date, low date, and so we don't have that all quite sorted out yet. But it seems to have to be either 1450 or 1425. Although there might be something in between there. I'm not so sure. People keep struggling with this and trying to make it more precise, but we just don't have the data to do that. But if you use the higher chronology, it fits very nicely with biblical history, and so I follow the higher chronology, at least for the 18th dynasty. Now, there's one other point I want to bring in here before we take our break. That is that the mummy, or there is a mummy identified as Thutmose III. I think we have almost all the mummies of the 18th dynasty pharaohs. But there's a problem with this mummy. A few years ago, there was a big program called X-raying the mummies. There's a book out on it where they examined them and checked out their teeth and bones and whatever they could learn about these mummies from X-raying and other types of studies. Well, they determined that this mummy of Thutmose III when he died, he was only 40 to 45 years old. Well, that's a problem, because Thutmose III ruled for 55 years. So it's possible that this is not the mummy of Thutmose III, but it is a substitute, and that the body of Thutmose III was lost in the Yam Suf, pursuing the Israelites. Of course, they would have to have a burial. There would have to be a body to be mummified and so on. And so they simply grabbed someone else and said, "This is the Pharaoh," and buried him in place of the old body.
Yeah.
He ruled for 55, yes.
Right, right. So he had to have been, well, he was quite young when he, you know, came on the throne, but he's got to be 60 or 70 or, you know, he's got to be older than 55 or 45, if they're accurate on their aging of that, that mummy.
Yeah. After when did they have the mummies from the late?
Ramses II, yeah.
Well,
he was 90-something, yeah. Okay, well, let's take a break for 10 minutes or so, and then we'll have a few slides and talk about the root of the Exodus.
Where are you going to be standing?
Well, probably. That's true.
Up here?
Yes.
About a quarter a day per year. And the question is, how long does it take to drift around a whole year? So it's roughly a quarter a day, it's roughly a quarter times 365. So it takes roughly 13 or 14 days to come around all at once. So I don't know how they made the observation. Sirius, I suppose, is probably visible in some eyes. It often
Well, we'll make a real quick trip out of this because we still want to talk about the root of the Exodus. But as I mentioned, I spent three seasons digging at Tel Mescuta in the Wadi Tumilat in the area of the land of Goshen. So I thought I should share some of my slides with you. Here's a satellite photo showing the area of the delta.
Where am I? This one's over here.
Okay. A little fuzzy. Oops, I got the wrong one.
That's the contrast between the cultivated land and the desert.
Yeah, the white is the desert. A little bit better. And it shows very clearly the Egyptian River Valley here, the whole delta region where the various branches of the Nile come out, and then the Wadi Tumilat here. The reason this is all green is because of irrigation, canals. And wherever there's no irrigation, it's desert, as you can see here from the white areas. Here's the Gulf of Suez here, the Red Sea. Gulf of Aqaba, Gulf of Elah here, the Sinai Peninsula. You can see the Dead Sea up here. And we talked about Lake Timsa here, at the end of the Wadi Tumilat. The Great Bitter Lake here. And this is the Suez Canal, coming through here, Port Said. So the land of Goshen then was this eastern delta area. Here, this is another close-up of the area of the Great Bitter Lake, Lake Timsa, and the Wadi Tumilat here, and the Suez Canal. Looks like a road going through there. The site I worked at is around here, and Tel Retab is located right next to it, right in the valley, very close to each other there. Yes? Well, we'll get into that. Yeah. Right now, just a general overview of the land of Goshen, and on the map we see it, this area here. It's basically the Wadi Tumilat, but took in regions to the north as well. Here's the canal that goes through the Wadi Tumilat, which provides the water for irrigation today. And there's a very clear line between the green and the desert, because when you stop irrigating, then immediately there's desert. So even next to the canal, you can see it's sand right up to the edge of the canal. The way the native people get across the canal is on these little hand boats or ferries. They pull themselves across. There's a road that runs through the valley, and then over here a railroad line as well. This is a little bridge that was out most of the time, but occasionally we could use it, a pontoon bridge a few
miles from where our site was located. Here's the site. We're looking across the road, the canal. The village of Mascoutah is located here, and we stayed in these buildings, the schoolhouse, during the summer to excavate, and the site is off to the left. The area is very fertile. Once it's irrigated, they get good crops. They get about 3 crops a year. You can see how high the corn is. Almost looks like Pennsylvania corn there. They grow figs. When we were there, usually in July, they were just harvesting the watermelon, so we got watermelon for breakfast.